Okay, everyone, welcome to our last of our Wednesday evening BIPs webinars for the year 2022. This is the right place. You come to the right place, the Economic and Cultural Renaissance at Carthage Herat with Dr. Siobhan Mahendrarajah of the University of St. Andrews. I'm very pleased that Siobhan has agreed to give this talk. He's a research fellow at the School of History at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He was educated at Columbia University and earned his PhD in Middle Eastern and Islamic History at the University of Cambridge. He is the author of a number of peer-reviewed articles on subjects such as Islamic history, Sufism, Wahhabism, Iran, Afghanistan, Mongols, and the Timurlane, and on counterinsurgency theory and practice on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban movements of both Afghanistan and Pakistan. He has to date two monographs in print, the first of which was published by Cambridge University Press, 2021. And this was The Sufi Saint of Jam, History of Religion and Politics of a Sunni Shrine in Shi'i Iran. And the latter, about which we're going to hear a little bit today, is A History of Herat from Chinggis Khan to Tamerlane, published by the Edinburgh University Press in 2022. Siobhan, the floor, as it were, is yours.
So thank you, Andrew, for the introduction, and my warm thanks to BIPs and to Sylvia. And Sylvia, thank you for saving me just now. And Imogen Edwards, Andrew Newman, and BIPs President Charles Melville for inviting me to this webinar and for making the logistical and publicity arrangements. Just as an FYI, as some of you know, when you have to give a presentation, that's the day you wake up with the coffees and the sneezes. And in my case, I woke up with some coffee, so if my voice breaks a bit, I apologize. So this is these are genealogies that are in the back of my History of Herat. Now, as the slide shows, there are genealogies of the Kart dynasty of Herat, and there's also the genealogy of some Sufis who married with them. The focus of this talk is about how Herat was resurrected, so to speak, after having been ruined by the Mongols. So the bulk of this talk will be on my recently published book that Andrew introduced, which is A History of Herat from Chinggis Khan to Tamerlane. However, during this period in question, that is from around 1220 to, 1250 to 1381, there were, apart from the Mongols and different Chinggisid factions, those are the children, heirs of Chinggis Khan, there were two major blocks that were involved in the politics of Herat and Khorasan. One of the two groups is the Kart dynasty of Herat. The Kartids, they originally came from the mountainous Gur region of eastern Iran in what is now called modern, what is called Afghanistan. They were brought over to Herat in 1251 by the Mongols and installed as their proxy. The second group are the Sufi sheikhs of Jam. They are in Tarbat-e-Jam in Iran. Now, this Jam is not to be confused, as often happens, with the Jam in modern Afghanistan. So this slide here shows the two genealogies, and they are in the appendix to the History of Herat. And it shows how the Kartic kings of Herat and the Sufis of Tarbat-e-Jam married each other. The Jami Sufis were a very powerful religious bloc, and they influenced the politics of Herat and its surroundings. Now, this is also a bit of a plug for both books. I have told the stories of the Jamis in the first book, The Sufi Saints, Sufi Saint of Jam. It's about them and their shrine complex. The story of the Kartids and Herat is in the second book. However, the two books are very closely connected, so please go ahead and buy both books. The History of Herat has multiple cross-references in the Sufi Saint of Jam, to the Sufi Saint of Jam, because I didn't want to repeat some of the information that's in the Sufi Saint of Jam in the History of Herat. Now, the Kartids, one of the reasons I split the two books is that the Kartids were eliminated by Tamerlane, or Timur, as he is known, but the Jami Sufis continue to thrive under Tamerlane. They are actually a living tradition. They continue now almost 900 years in existence. They are still quite active in Iran. Now, the Jami Sufis even though they were allied with the Carthids and had married with the Carthids, they secretly worked with Timur to help him capture Herat. They did this to save the city, but also to guarantee for themselves survival, political survival, as well as economic rewards. So much of the story will be, as I mentioned, on the history of, from the history of Herat. But for those who are interested and want to read, you need to also have the first book, so can refer back to some of the characters and some of the events, as well as the genealogies of the Sufi saints that are in that book. This is their shrine. The Sunni shrine at Jam continues, you know, like I said, to thrive. Now, as you may have guessed from this comment earlier about how the Sufis of Jam worked with Tamerlane secretly, the politics of Herat were very complex. Political and the military histories of this period, roughly from about 1220 to 1381, 1220 is around when the Mongols started to invade, to 1381 when Tamerlane invaded. This period consumes very much almost all of the medieval history of Herat, the Tarikh-Name-i Herat by Saif al-Harbi, which ends around 1322 with his death. So the political and military history is a lot, and I can't get into it here because it's not easy to summarize that much. Plus, a lot of it is frightfully boring. So first, I should geographically situate Herat in this story. The map that you see is found in the book. On the eve of the Mongol invasions of Iran in 1220, the ancient Iranian province of Khorasan was divided into four administrative regions, or quarters, as they were called at the time. That was the language they used, rob, from the Arabic. Clockwise, you have Marv, Balkh, Herat, and Nishapur. Now, each of the four cities of the four quarters of Khorasan were located in oases, with both overground or underground, with overground and or underground water resources. Now, the medieval economy was largely agricultural, so water was critical, not just for human survival, but for the local economies. Now, I bring this up is because water is very central to this story. Herat, this map is also in the book, and it might sort of give you a better idea of where everything is situated, not just the city of Herat, but where everything stands in terms of Central Asia, India, and other parts of Iran. Herat, as you can see, sits on the eastern edge of the Iranian plateau. To Herat's east, southeast, and northeast are found mountains, including the Hindu Kush. Now, this is clear from this map, where you can see more of the waterways and the water bodies, which are identified here. One of the very big ones, like Lake Sistan, just west of Zaranj, as you can see, and the Hari Rud is a big one, the Herat River, which runs just below Herat City. Now, the surroundings of Herat, the city, include hundreds, probably thousands of farmlands, hectares of farmlands and pastures. It's actually a very lush area because of the Herat River Valley. And so if you move along east of Herat or through the Herat River Valley, you will find lots of settlements and farmlands as well. Now, now when the Mongols invaded, the four cities that I had mentioned, Balkh, Herat, Marv, and Nishapur, were very well populated and thriving. The Mongols crossed the Oxus into Iran in late 1220. First reconnaissance, then in pursuit of the Shah, who had offended Genghis Khan. And then Genghis Khan crossed the Oxus in winter 1220, 1221, and initiated the siege of Bach. Now, I cannot get into this complex sequence of battles and sieges and about which Mongol army was deployed where and when. The history of Herat, my history of Herat, includes the chronology of the Mongol invasions and the sequences of battles and sieges in places like Marv, Herat, Balkh, Nishapur, Bamiyan, and Parvan. This slide here is just one page from this multi-page chronology. The main takeaway of the Mongol invasions of Khorasan with respect to the focus of this talk is that cities, villages, farms, and hydrological systems were ruined. And Khorasan was depopulated. And as you can see from the slide, by deportation, I mean that the Mongols took young women, boys, able-bodied men, and also people with skills, craftsmen, artisans, engineers, while other people fled to safer parts of Iran and to Anatolia, India, Egypt, and the Hejaz. But with people gone, either through death, deportation, or having become refugees, the local economy basically collapsed. Now, Professor Peter Jackson, in his book, a wonderful book, The Mongols in the Islamic World, devotes an entire chapter to the subject of depopulation and to analyzing what the contemporary as well as the later sources have said about the carnage inflicted by the Mongols. Some of what has been written by Persian and Arabic writers on the Mongols is exaggerated, and Professor Jackson does a very good job of analyzing this. Now, with respect to Herat, for example, claims of medieval writers of 2.4 million people being dead, being killed is, you know, poppycock. But that was a brain drain, as you can see from this slide, and hydrological systems are very important. Waterways, dams, sluices, timers, etc., were either wrecked or they fell into disrepair when engineers and the water managers, Mirab, fled or were deported because they're also technicians and engineers. And so hundreds of thousands of acres of land fell fallow and social and economic activities declined. Oops, sorry, shouldn't have jumped ahead. Now, the slide summarizes some of this stuff, but irrespective of how many people were killed or deported, we can be sure that the social and economic harms inflicted on Khorasan were catastrophic. But with respect to some of these numbers about people being killed, it's really good for people to keep in mind is that, you know, people didn't just stand around waiting to be captured by the Mongols and to be killed. The history of the Jami, Sufis, for example, makes clear that the Sufi community knew that the Mongols were coming into town. They fled, almost the entire community fled up to the Binalud Mountains near Mashhad. And there's a very good description of that in the original histories as well as in my work. So we can be sure that there were other villages who also fled up to the mountains of Eastern Iran, Ghur and other places, and the Panjshir, for example, and other parts of the Hindu Kush to avoid the Mongols. There were also people who were better placed financially. And they, again, we can, you know, go back to the Jami Sufis, some of the sheikhs who had the money. They packed up and went off to India or to the Hejaz or Anatolia. Actually, those who went to India, they established long-standing ties with the Delhi Sultanate and with other Indian Muslims. Lastly, Herat's hydrological network, which is, as you can see, waterways and dams and such, they're mostly above ground. Now, this is fortunate because above ground waterways, which is basically a channel, a river, these are much easier to repair than the underground waterways. And by underground waterways, I mean what we call in Arabic the kanat, or in Persian, the kharis. This is Sketch Map of Herat by Oscar von Niedermayer. It was published in 1915. He visited a little bit earlier. Now, this map is illustrative only, just so as to make certain points, and you can see some of the points are in the text on the left, which I will not read out to you. I like Niedermayer. I use Niedermayer's map is because his eye was quite keen. He he was a spy for the German government, military. His eye recorded details that British army officers and British intelligence officers did not notice, or if they did notice them, didn't bother to put them in their sketch map. So Niedermayer's map, for my purposes, which are to get into more in the book, is actually quite brilliant. His keen eye was very helpful. But the thing that I want you to kind of absorb from here is the dimensions of the city and its general layout. Pre-Mongol Herat had a square in the city. It's very, very rare in that respect, not rare, but unusual to have square city. So perfect, you know, almost mile by mile with the walls, gates, bastions, and towers. This is the way it was laid out when the Mongols attacked. However, outside the square wall city lay what we today would call suburbs. Now, exactly how big the suburbs were on the eve of the Mongol conquest, or how large the population, these are debatable. The suburbs had many graveyards, Sufi shrines, homes, gardens, madrasas, khanqahs, bazaars, mosques, the whole works. So it was in many ways, Herat was in many ways a very big city, not just at one mile by 1 mile square inner city, but that inner city was the political and economic heart of the city, of Herat. Now, this is the same map, but I have circled the locations of the city gates and the corner bastions. Carted Herat, we know, had 5 gates, but pre-Mongol Herat probably had just 4 gates. But it's important to keep in mind that defensive circumvallations and castles had postern gates. These are small sites. These gates basically regulate pedestrian traffic. And they may not be recorded by geographers and historians the way they identify the principal gateways. The principal gateways are, as you can see, east, southwest, and then in the northwest, and later on, the northeast as well. And these postern gates, I mean, anyone who's been to a castle or even a Cambridge college has probably passed through seeing a postern gate. Many posterns are small, which, you know, force a person to bend over a bit in order to enter. The goal is to make it difficult to charge inside with your sword while bent double. So there may have been a fifth gate in the northeast, but was not recorded. Now, and I'll explain why I'm going to the exercise in a jiffy. Now on this slide, you can see basically what was, you know, we want to get into what was destroyed and not destroyed by the Mongols. And part of the reason for this is that there is a lot of exaggeration in the histories that the city was, you know, millions were killed and just completely ruined and flattened and so on. Not entirely true. So let's go through this here. The inner wall city, you know, was large, as you know, 4 miles, or if you do the new money, 6 kilometers, with a mound. The mound was probably like 40 to 50 feet high. And on top of this mound or embankment is what you will find the city walls. And the bastions are on the corners. They hold up the walls as well as support the embankment. And there are towers built on the walls as well. Those are defensive towers where they fire the arrows and the crossbows from there. Once the Mongols took the city of Herat, the Mongol commander ordered breaches struck in the walls at strategic points. And for all of the gates to be extracted. And for sections of the trench, which runs along around the city as well, to be filled in. And for the Merlons, and that's why this little thing on the side here shows you what the Merlons and the Cornells are and the parapet wall. For those to be broken. Now, this is also what Tamerlane did. And there's a very good explanation in the history on Tamerlane that says how he did it, and also about the Mongol commander. So this is what you would, you know, in today's military language, you would call standard operating procedure. No medieval, you know, military commander would have done it differently, because there was no need to flatten everything in Herat. There's a practical reason for this. It's not easy to do this when you're dealing with miles of walls, some of them 30 and 40 and 50 feet high, and you don't have bulldozers and tanks. So humans and draft animals had to do the heavy work of pulling down towers. So this was an expedient way to go about it. So it was not necessary to flatten everything. And I have drawn the arrows in here to show you that once the gates are removed and the sections of the trench are filled in, it's easy for the army to go back in if they want to go in. But the reason why I went through this exercise is because the second reason is if somebody decided to rebuild the city and to repopulate it, the process is easier to reverse than if the city had been completely flattened. Like a city like Nishapur, for example, when it was destroyed by earthquake, for example, a new one was rebuilt next to it. So Herat was rebuilt on top of what already existed, or renovations of existing. We will get to that in soon. The citadel suffered the same fate as the city's defensive circumvallations. However, many city buildings inside the square survived. The most famous survivor of from Herat is its famous Friday mosque, the Masjid de Jami. And today it's well over 800 years old. And even then, at the time the Mongols invaded 1222, took Herat, 1222, it was quite famous even then because of its architecture and the size. The image that you see is, of course, the more modern one taken a couple of years ago when I was last in Herat. This is the Mongol era mosque, but of course, with plenty of renovations, it was dilapidated for about 100 years after the Mongols captured Herat. So I went through this to show you that once the Mongols were done and gone, you know, they technically didn't leave very far, although Herat was depopulated, a stump of the citadel survived. Major and minor buildings survived inside the square, and stumps of the city's circumvallations, the mound, etc., survived, but the gates were not there. Gates were gone. 30 years after the Mongols got done, you know, pillaging and killing in Herat, the Mongols decided to repopulate Herat and to allow some rebuilding, but not full-scale rebuilding. Now, I'll explain why they didn't, you know, about the full-scale building business later. This slide shows the three key reasons for the Mongols' decision to revivify Herat. They wanted to develop the economy, tax, bring people back, draft them, and they wanted to extract merchandise that was produced in Herat, in the Herat quarter. I get into more detail in the book on Mongol, on why the Mongols did this with respect to Herat. The best study in Mongol imperial policies and why they decided to, you know, to rejuvenate cities like Herat, Iran, and also in China is by Tom Olson, titled Mongol Imperialism. Tom Olson, late Tom Olson, gets into the nitty-gritty of Mongol policies on taxation, conscription, and centralization. Now, the candidate chosen by the Mongols to rule things here in Herat was Shamsuddin Muhammad Kart. He was a loyalist. He was a Mongol loyalist. He was originally from Gur in the mountains of eastern Iran. He was given a yarlig, which is a ruling patent, money, arms, etc., and sent off to Herat to implement the Mongol Khan's will. Now, this is easier. This was easier said than done. Shamsuddin Kart had to fight or negotiate with petty lords, as well as with other Chinggisid stakeholders. Now, these Chinggisid stakeholders being other children of Genghis Khan and their offshoot. And there were rivalries among the heirs of Genghis Khan, petty jealousies, intrigues, great deal of violence. There was banditry. So the area in and around Herat was actually quite unstable and with violent, you know, and violent with bands running around pillaging and robbing anybody they could. And as such, that contributed to depopulation, to continued depopulation, because nobody wanted to come back to a place that was anarchic. So Shamsuddin Kart and his successors had to develop a network of petty lords that recognized Herat's authority over them. They had to either fight them or negotiate with them. And the security in the region waxed and waned. There were times when it would be very good, so times when it was pretty bad. The situation that the Kartids faced was not unlike what was going on in Afghanistan. And that's why I have the quip up there. It's hard to do nation building while being shot at. This is actually one of the things that people used to say in Afghanistan. And it's quite true also for the Kartids. Because this is exactly what they faced for decades. They were trying to establish a political system to repopulate the city, to help the economy develop, rebuild a little bit. But they had to deal with a lot of violent actors and factions and armed groups running around them. So the political military histories of the Kartids and the Ilkhanids consumes about 5 chapters in my history of Herat. I didn't really want to have to write that much political and military history, but if I didn't do it, I would not have been able to contextualize properly the social and economic developments that came later. So chapter 1 of the book is about the Mongol invasion. That was essentially that down. Chapters 2 to 6 cover the periods from 1220 to 1381. 1381 is when Tamerlane took the city. Now, this is obviously a very long and complex history. I have Charles Melville's quote down here because I think it's an interesting quote, because it sort of encapsulates really what the Kartids faced while they tried to rebuild Herat. Now, he was talking in general about Iranian history, but I think it applies, or at least it sums up what the Kartids were facing. Here the Kartids were trying to rebuild the city and to reinvigorate the agricultural economy. But the city of Herat and its surroundings were raided many times by predators, including Mongol factions from Central Asia. The Mongols, they had a network of petty lords. It took them a while to build up a group of people who were loyal to them. I refer to them in the book as Bandagan, which is an old term from Farsi, means bondsman or loyal bondsman. However, there were a lot of rebellions even among these so-called loyal bondsmen. Some of the bondsmen were not always loyal and were rebel or defect to this or that Mongol faction. And then there were intrigues in the Mongol court, there were intrigues in the Kartid court. There was also a coup d'etat that was planned by the Sufis of Jam that deposed one of the Kartid rulers. The Kartid court in Tabriz was also rife with intrigues and factionalism. And that impacted on events in Khorasan as well as in Herat. And then the Mongols refused to allow the Kartids to rebuild within the 4 square walls. Anything that was built had to be built outside the square walls. So that's why I mentioned Charles Melville's comment, because the main stuff of history takes up almost half the book of trying to talk about all these rebellions, the factionalism with the different groups of Genghis's, the intrigues in the Carding court, and the coup d'etat. But security was paramount. No security, no cultural or economic development. I mean, it really was as simple as that. Because the Praetors, as you can see from the screen, they didn't just come in and rob people and leave. I mean, they pillaged, murdered, and they took people as slaves because human beings were commodities back then. You could buy and sell them. And so nobody would want to come live in a part of Khorasan or in Herat if they were at risk of being raped, pillaged, murdered, or enslaved. So the Kartans had to provide security in and around the city of Herat. Highways and byways had to be safe for travelers and those traders who wanted to bring in merchandise, but also for the transportation of produce from farms. And also, for nomads who might want to come in and trade meat, milk for cereals. Now, there was economic progress in and around Herat between 1251 and 1300. The city had regained some residents, but it's not really clear where the population stood around 1300. There were censuses taken, but only the details of one Mongol census were published. We know from various reports, and sometimes vague reports, that there was economic progress. A couple of bazaars were built, several shops, and a workshop was also built, but they were all outside the city. The old bazaars that were inside the city just stayed in ruins up until about 1300. Now this changed in 1300, and this is because the reigning Kart Malik ruler was very strong-headed. He defied the Mongols, even though they had said you can't do any construction inside the city, and most of all you couldn't rebuild defenses, he went ahead and did it anyway. So he started rebuilding the city's defenses. The citadel, which is what we today call the Kilae Akhtiar Adin, was rebuilt. The city walls, gates, bastions, etc., were all rebuilt. The descriptions and narratives in Saif al-Harabi's History of Herat, the Tarikh-Name-i Herat, which terminates around 1322, shows that the Herat's defenses were very strong and imposing. This is Kilae Ikhtiar al-Din Citadel. It's shining now and looks really beautiful from recent renovations. I think I took these pictures in 2019, last time I was there. It is not reflective, of course, of the Carded period citadel, but the photos show how the citadel imposes over the city. You can even see them on the picture on the left. You can see the Masjid-e Jami in the far background. Unfortunately, some of the best photos that I have of Herat are on a hard disk that's not with me. If not, I'd show you something a bit more helpful. Anyway, this is another illustrative slide. It just shows an assortment of archaeological sites from Rick Ball's fine book. But all of these sites are not necessarily military. They include mosques, shrines, etc. But note how they concentrate in and around human settlements. And that's really one of the things I want you as a takeaway from this. Forts and garrisons were essential to protect villages, grain silos, settlements, and hydrological systems, and the roads, whether they're minor roads or major roads. The Kartids basically had to do the same thing in and around. This is actually taken from the Timurid period. Same thing around Herat. Now it's key to understand the Kartids did not have the money to engage in large-scale nation-building projects throughout their domains. And these domains stretch from west of Herat, south, east, and northwards. So this is why they needed this network of local amirs or bandagan, however you want to call them, who would protect a particular locality. Now, we don't know exactly what their contracts were between the Kart rulers in Herat and, say, a bandagan in Kandahar or in Balkh or somewhere in Bamiyan, wherever it might be. We don't know exactly what the agreements were, but the Bundagan probably just sent back, kicked back some of the taxes that they collected. In exchange, the Carthage would send in the army to help them. And the army by the 1300s was quite formidable. And they were actually very adept at both, not just warfare, but also in defense in terms of sieges and counter siege as well. And so they would provide protection to their loyal allies while going off and beating up anybody who was disloyal. So what the Carthage created here was not a centralized state, but a loosely connected network of allies who supplied Herat with intelligence, tribute, protected agricultural communities, and protected highways and byways, thereby allowing for people and merchandise to move back and forth. I have, by the way, focused more in this book on trade along the routes to the south of Herat. Westwards, going westwards into central Iran and then down into the Persian Gulf and eastwards to Kandahar and to Ghazni. The last two cities, Kandahar and Ghazni, have been historical transit points for goods to and from India. In many other studies, for example, writers have focused on Central Asian trade, the so-called Silk Route, which is why I wanted to focus on what I think is a neglected area, namely trade along the southern routes into what you would, you know, what are today Sistan, Balochistan, and Kandahar and Ghazni, and then from there to the various passes into India. These are the waterways leading from the Herat River or the Hari Rud towards Herat. As you can see, there are many water bodies. I have just identified on this map just the main irrigation channels. Here also, the Carthage didn't have the money to engage in any large-scale development projects for the hydrological network. They did engage in a few small irrigation projects, which they, you know, with agreements and payments out of pocket, you know, they also did, like such as building cisterns, dams, and developing juis being a waterway. But they left most of the development to private enterprises, large landholders, namely Islamic institutions such as khanqahs, madrasas, Sufi shrines. As some of you may know, during the Carthage period, during the Timurid period, some of these big shrine complexes, like Abdullah Ansari's, and I have written about the Jami's, and then towards the end, as Robert McChesney has written about the shrine in Balkh, they were big managers of land and water. And these things originated with, I wouldn't say originated, but they kind of picked up steam under the Carthage in giving Islamic institutions control of land and water in order to let them develop these institutions, these economic resources. And of course, the government taxed these agriculture. So the Carthage funded and developed or repaired a number of khanqahs, madrasas, Sufi shrines. They renovated Herat's Friday Mosque. They built other mosques. And sorry, I hope I'm not running out. Okay. I'll be wrapping up in a second. So they built mosques. They kept the seven graveyards of Herat clean and manicured, and they rebuilt bazaars and caravanserais. Unfortunately, what we don't know is how they taxed commerce, at what rates and what tolls they collected at bridges and city gates. Under the Timurids, for example, we know what the trade taxes were, you know, what was sold in the bazaar, what came into the city. They applied the tamga tax on it. But for the Carthage, we don't know, but it is common practice to tax goods coming into the city. So we can assume, but we cannot prove that they did so. Oops. Sorry. Okay. This is an appendix from the history of Herat. It's just one page of many. This is a list of the structures that the Carthage either built or rebuilt. By rebuilt, I mean buildings that had survived the Mongols but were in bad shape. As you can see, some of these things like cisterns, bazaars, and of course seminaries, meaning the madrasas and the Masjid Jami. I try to give as much information and cross-references as is possible. So I need to wrap up. Once security returned to Herat and its surroundings, social and economic progress followed. There has been much written about Timurid Herat, about how Herat was a splendid place and allowed artists like Behzad to thrive and the poets like Nuruddin Abdurrahman Jami to flourish, and how Herat was an epicenter of Naqshbandi Sufism. All true. But credit should be given to the Qaris for helping to revive Herat. I mean, it took them almost 130 years of rule, during which they faced many obstacles. Herat was slowly rebuilt. Its agricultural and manufacturing economy is about to revive. The Qaris also revived or created Islamic posts like the Sheikh al-Islam, the Sadr, and the Sadr al-Sharia. The market inspector was also employed. All of this to institute Islamic laws and to allow to regulate practices in the bazaars and to provide religious guidance to Heratis. There are some manshurs or decrees and such, which I also refer to in the book, but can't really get into here, of course. So anyway, these offices, especially the Sadr and the Sheikh al-Islam, were continued by the Timurids. Sadr became a powerful post in the Timurid Empire, and later under the Safavids. Sheikh al-Islam, an office that originated near Balkh before the Mongols, spread to India, China, the Arab world, and the Ottoman Empire. Part of its role in preserving cultural institutions like that of the Sheikh al-Islam and proliferating institutions like that of the Sadr are not negligible. Lastly, credit must also go to the Sultan's Ajam for negotiating with Tamerlane a soft landing for Herat. And the soft landing, meaning Herat really wasn't ruined by Tamerlane. It is actually a very relatively peaceful surrender. The last Qardid ruler was determined to fight Tamerlane, which would have led to the ruin and depopulation of Herat, which is why the Sufis, Jam, and other ulama and so on had a deal, so to speak, with Tamerlane. You know, compared to, you know, Tamerlane, Genghis Khan was actually quite a reasonable fellow. Timur enjoyed inflicting violence and mayhem for the sake of violence and mayhem. I think we all heard about how he built pyramids of skulls and did all sorts of horrible things. An example of what could have happened to Herat was at the city of Fujange, next to Herat, just a few days before Tamerlane's army surrounded the city of Herat in Muharram 783. There was a great loss of life and damage at Fujange. Now, if Herat had fought Tamerlane just as fiercely as Fushanj did, and other cities did later, like Isfahan most famously, the Herat story might have ended very differently. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was really terrific. My own question has to do with continuity of peoples, elites, whom I imagine you can track over this period. Now, you've talked about the Sufis of Jam and such in the Sufi order. Right. I wonder if there are other, by tracing families who before, during, and after the Mongol invasions and such, was there some continuity there, father, son, grandson, and such, who were in service, any sort of administrative roles or landowners, any continuity or any great changes in names of people or numbers of holdings, that sort of thing?
Yeah, actually, it's a good question, Andrew. Did I mute myself by mistake? No, I didn't. Okay, good. I do a lot of stupid things at times with the technology. So anyway, all right. So actually, the continuity is a very good point, because as I'm sure you may be knowing, what's his name? Taftazani family. Sardarian Taftazani was Sheikh al-Islam under the Qardids. And his heirs held that post right through to the end of the Sunni period in Herat's history. In fact, the last Taftazani was executed by Shah Ismail I. I think if the report is true, he was burned alive in the bazaar in Herat for refusing to accept Shiism. And that was 1506. So that one family stayed held the post of Sheikh al-Islam of Herat for 150 odd years. The other one are the Imami family. They were the chief justices of Herat. Again, from like around the 1350s till the end of the Sunni period of Herat history, that was one family. Throughout the entire Timurid period and the last couple of decades of the Carted period, they held it. So that, those are two very important jobs. And so that too is, you know, I really think is a good credit to what the Cartids did. Land holdings is a bit tough because as you know, with waqfs and so on, you're not supposed to be, you know, they're perpetual, but somebody comes, next ruler comes in and he just takes it away. And this did happen, for example, with the Sibs of Jam. They had a lot of stuff. Then they owned great of land. I've actually seen some of these documents, but then the Safavids come around and say, well, it's a Sunni shrine, so bye-bye, you lose out. So no, it's not been, and record keeping has really been abysmal, as you know, and in the Persianate world. I mean, I think unless one is lucky enough to be working on the Ottoman archives these days, it's very hard to be able to document if somebody held on to something. But some of the shrines did thrive right in through like the 1500s.
That's terrific. Thank you very much. I'm going to wrap it up. Everybody, thank you very much. And may I wish you a good, pleasant of the evening.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.